Get to Old Navy for star-spangled style. Right now, everything's on sale, up to 60% off. That's right, get everything from tees, shorts, dresses, and swim, all at 60% off. Now till July 7th at Old Navy and OldNavy.com. Valid through 7/7, select styles only.
This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
It's the evening edition. I'm Tasha Fusil, and this is Happily Ever After, the series that takes a closer look at the fairy tales that we grew up and fell in love with once upon a time. Now, there's a few ways to enjoy a fairy tale. There are books, films, there's artwork. But I think most of us can agree that there hasn't been a fairy tale more watched or more loved than the ones Walt Disney created. But unless you're an animator yourself, it can be a little bit difficult to appreciate just how much goes into making some of our most loved fairy tales. So to help us figure that out tonight is a seriously gifted animator.
My name is John Kanemaker, and I'm an animator and a professor of animation history and production at New York University. And I've written 12 books on the history of animation, and my whole life revolves around animation, apparently.
On top of that, John has won an Academy and Emmy Award for an animated short about him and his dad called The Moon and the Sun, an Imagined Conversation. It's lovely and thoughtful, and I recommend that you guys check it out. Anyway, we'll find out more about how John came to be such an accomplished animator in a bit, but for now, I thought we could start with John telling us a bit about how Pinocchio was made. Now, Pinocchio was originally a series of stories that were published in an Italian newspaper way back in 1881. But when Walt Disney acquired the rights, he found that there were a couple of problems trying to animate the story. First of all, it was too long, so he and his team spent quite a lot of time sketching the stories out and then cutting them up and down through this whole process of trial and error. So that took some time. And then secondly, it was the character Pinocchio himself.
The lead character Pinocchio in the original story was a monstrous child. Just very mischievous and even cruel. He kills the cricket in the book and within the first few pages. So Disney took the cricket character and embellished it, and Jiminy Cricket becomes, you know, one of the top stars of the film itself.
But the bigger problem was what to do with Pinocchio's personality. They tried everything, but they didn't know how to make a puppet that was appealing. So after months of trying different kinds of animation, Walt Disney actually stopped the entire production.
And they spent 6 months trying to figure out how to make Pinocchio an appealing character. Finally, one of the animators named Milt Call did some drawings of a little boy who happened to have wooden arms and wooden joints and his legs. And the charm of the boy was there, but also then the appearance of the puppet.
So with that new and improved look, they were able to start their production again.
And the character went on to become, you know, very popular with the audience.
Wow, okay. So that means that, you know, the Pinocchio that we see today, it had to go through quite a number of iterations to get to that level of...
Absolutely. At least three or four iterations that he became less and less puppet-like and more boy-like as the iterations happened. But it was literally a metamorphosis because the first version was very obnoxious and did not appeal. That was changed, but it took a lot of work and actually spending a lot of money. 6 months not working on the film, but having people, you know, waiting around for things to do is a very expensive prospect for a studio.
I hope that gives a rough idea of how complex it is to give life to what's essentially an inanimate picture, especially back in the 30s when it was all hand-drawn animation. But drawing was where it all started for John, who is our guest this evening.
Well, I've always drawn as a child, and when I was a teenager in the 1950s, I made a short animated film. At that time, there weren't schools to teach you how to animate, but there were a couple of books. So I read those, and then I made my own films. There were also two television shows, the Disneyland TV show in which Walt Disney would sometimes explain how to do animation. And then
presenting this week, the story of the animated drawing.
Also Walter Lantz's Woody Woodpecker show, and he also explained how animation was produced.
It was quite a problem deciding just how Woody should look.
So with that, you know, basic knowledge, I was able to make my own film. And then later, when I came to New York over a period of years, I learned more about making animated films and started to work in the industry itself.
And what was it about animation and drawing that really drew you in?
What was it that drew me in? Just the fact that I could interpret the world in my own way, in my way of drawing, and to make it move in animation was a plus. As I say, I always had the ability to draw, but then to take those drawings and make sequences of them and make them move and then communicate and affect audiences, that was another big plus for animation.
I imagine at that time, how old were you when you were making those really rough cuts of you know, your first films?
I was probably around 15.
Well, that's pretty young, I mean, like, to take up a hobby like this. So was it something that you picked up purely from the books and whatever you had seen on TV, or did you have someone around you that was creatively inclined?
Well, there were teachers. There was one teacher who had a camera that you could shoot frame by frame, and he knew a little bit about how animation was done. There was also a person who ran an art shop in the small town that I came from, and he actually had some original, what they call cells, from Fantasia. I remember he had a Mickey Mouse cell, you know, where he plays the Sorcerer's Apprentice. He had one of those, so I was able to look at those and sort of study them and try to emulate them and make my own drawings for films. It wasn't until I got to New York several years later that I seriously started to seek out education here in New York at the School of Visual Arts, and then I went to graduate school at New York University and started to make my own films as a journeyman animator here in New York.
I think a lot of people, when they watch animation, they can feel it, right? They're feeling some sort of emotional connection to it, but you can't quite understand why it is that it's so powerful. Like, what exactly is it about animation that makes it such a good tool for storytelling?
I think a couple of things. First of all, if you're speaking specifically about Disney animation, they do pretty much the same thing that live-action films do. They use cutting. They use staging to communicate directly with the audience. Color, music, all of those elements that live-action uses are things that can bring an audience closer to animation, which is a drawn or and now a digital art form. But I think there's something additional that animation does. It actually can personify thought if you want it to. It can exaggerate emotions so that they're a little bit bigger, almost like silent movies used to do with the silent comedians. They go a little bit bigger than real life, and I think that ability to use metamorphosis, for example, to change from one thing to another, is another property of animation that goes a bit beyond what live action can do. On the other hand, there are things that live action has as an advantage that animation can not quite compete with, and that would be, say, the close-up of a human face. When you have a star, say, Katharine Hepburn or, you know, of Meryl Streep, for example, I mean, there's nothing like the human face for nuance and really getting across a feeling of emotion. With animation, it's much more difficult to do that, particularly drawn animation. You have to make things a little bit bigger than they would be in real life, and sometimes there's the danger of going too far. I think that's also why the accomplishments of the Disney studio were so impressive when they did, you know, say Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Here were characters that were, for the most part, based on humans, and yet they were cartoons. How do you cross that border and make people care about cartoons so much so that they're afraid they might, quote, you know, die in the film? And in fact, Snow White was required to pass away in the film. And to make that believable was an extremely difficult thing to accomplish in animation. They did it, and they did it wonderfully in a number of other films through the years. But it was quite a feat and quite a breakthrough when that happened.
We'll talk more about the animated work that was coming out of the Disney studios when we come back. It's the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Hi, I'm Jay Farner, CEO of Quicken Loans. 30% of Americans who are planning home improvements of $5,000 or more will pay for those renovations with a high-interest credit card. That may not be a great idea. A better idea may be to take cash out of your home with a Quicken Loans 30-year fixed-rate mortgage. The rate today on our 30-year fixed-rate mortgage is 4.375%. APR, 4.65%. Call us today at 800-QUICKEN or go to rocketmortgage.com.
Rate subject to change. Pay 2.13% fee to receive this discounted rate. Call for cost information and conditions. Equal housing lender. License in all 50 states. NMLS number 3030.
Break from monotony. BFM 89.9.
Welcome back to Happily Ever After on the Evening Edition. I'm Tasha Fusil, and along with my guest tonight, John Canemaker, who is an animation historian and professor of animation at NYU, we've been talking about fairy tales and animation. Today, it's pretty hard to imagine one without the other, and the man to credit for that is none other than Walt Disney himself.
Disney's animation, in terms of his own work, goes back to the silent era. He worked on films back in Kansas City, where he came from. But some of them were fairy tales, but they were silent fairy tales. They were very exaggerated and cartoony. The big star of the 1920s was Felix the Cat. Do you know that character?
I have vague memories of it.
Yeah. Well, it was a black and white character that could take parts of its body and change them into other things. His tail might become a fishing pole, for example, or a baseball bat. But he was a fantastic character, but he also had personality. He connected with the audience. The audience felt they knew who Felix the Cat was.
And so Walt Disney took that kind of personality that Felix had and went much bigger with it and applied it to some of his earliest feature-length fairy tale animations.
About 1937 is when Snow White came along, and then after that came Pinocchio and Fantasia in 1940. But in Snow White, they really had to work very hard to convince people of the reality of what these characters were going through. The dwarfs at the end of the film are crying over this allegedly departed cartoon character, Snow White. And to make that convincing was an extremely difficult thing to do and a great challenge. And that they were able to do it was a terrific success. It really moved the history of animation forward a great deal.
How were they able to do that?
Well, I asked Frank Thomas, who animated the scene of the dwarfs crying over Snow White. I said, Frank, how did you do that? And he said, well, there are a number of things. First of all, you get a whole bunch of drawings of how the dwarfs might look when they're grieving. If you've ever seen Giotto's painting of the Lamentation, you can see that the characters around the dead character are grieving in different kinds of ways. So at the Disney Studios, someone would be drawing different poses of the character. Is it better to have the characters looking downward? Is it better to have them seated rather than standing? Would it be better to have, say, one character leaning on the other one or having its arm around another character to comfort them? All of these poses communicate something of grieving to the audience. And so when you've got all of these, you then start to pick out the strongest storytelling poses that you can. You want to make a very strong statement. So you have many choices. So you go in and you find the best choices within those drawings. Those become your extreme poses. That means that's the storytelling pose, or what the animators used to call the golden pose. That tells a story right there in that one drawing. Now, if you put another drawing after that, because animation is a flurry of drawings, it's a sequence of drawings. Some of them, 24 drawings go by in 1 second on the screen. You put another drawing next to that, and that might be the second pose that you hit. Something different happens in it. And then you put the in-between drawings between them. But you've already got the emotion worked out, you've got the staging of the drawings worked out, and you're communicating with the audience visually. And that's the way you work it throughout the entire film.
Would you say that was probably the most challenging scene for that particular movie to animate?
That was one of them. The other scene that was difficult, do you remember the scene, the sequence where Snow White is in the woods, and the huntsman takes out a knife and is about to kill her. Well, that again was a very difficult scene, because how do you make that convincing? Again, you have two cartoon characters, and what is it about the drawings and the staging of it that can communicate danger to the audience, that this Snow White might possibly be murdered in, you know, right there in the, in that particular scene? So again, they had to figure out ways, and they spent months trying to figure out, well, should we have her back? You know, should she be leaning down talking to a little bird?
Hello there. What's the matter? Where's your mom and papa?
And then the huntsman comes up behind her. Or do we cut to the front view of the huntsman as he pulls out the knife and he comes toward the camera? Do we use shadows instead of showing the actual hand coming forward with the knife? All of these things are creative decisions which affect the animation and make it real for the audience. And as I say, it's a way of using live-action techniques, but with drawings and with, you know, and now today with computer animation as well. The principles are still there. You know, you're still trying to elicit an emotional response from the audience, and you have to do it through the materials and the tools that you have. It's either drawings or it's pixels. But the principles are the same. Am I making any sense?
Yes. You are. But at the same time, I'm thinking about the infinite possibilities or the many things you would have to try in order to find out which combination will work best. And it just sounds like it would take forever.
Well, that's why you have a director.
True.
That's why you have someone who says, okay, this is good, let's go with that, or this is terrible, do it again. And that's what Walt Disney was. He was, you know, very involved with all of his productions, particularly the early features, Snow White, Pinocchio, Fantasia, Dumbo, and Bambi. Those he really was focused on. Later on, his interest in other things like live action and television and the Disneyland parks and all of that kind of diluted his attention away from film. But in those first five features, he was quite with it, and you know, he's the one who really had the final say on what went into the films. And the animators themselves, before presenting something, also did their own testing. I mean, once you animate the scene, say on paper, then you can photograph it, these rough drawings, and then you can look at it over and over again, and you can kind of see, well, maybe this works too slow here, and maybe this action should be speeded up a little bit more. And then you try different things, and then, you know, re-photograph it again, look at it again, show it to other people, show it to fellow animators, and then you go and show it to the big boss, who would be Walt Disney. Sometimes there would be supervising directors who would be there before Walt Disney was. And then there was a hierarchy with animators. There was a master animator, and below them there were assistants. And then below those, there were the lowest of the low, which were in-betweeners. These were people who put drawings in between the main golden drawings that I mentioned, the extreme poses that tell the story. But it was a studio. It was a factory system, and it worked very much like that, except it was an artistic factory.
Okay, so with something like Snow White, how many animators were involved with that, and how long did it take for the entire production to be completed?
Well, there were approximately about 800 people who worked on the film at that time. When they did Fantasia, which was 3 years later, there were 1,200 people at the studio that worked on the films. And they had, you know, several films going at the same time. The production of Snow White began really around 1934, when Walt Disney was seriously considering that particular subject for the film. It really came into being with story work, a script, preliminary drawings in 1935. Then there were more refinements made in 1936. And finally, for that last year, was when the animation kicked in, and they premiered the film in toward the end of 1937. So it was pretty much, for that particular film, a four-year project. Most animated features take about 2 to 3 years, mostly 3 years. and a lot of it is story work. Story is the most important thing. In fact, Walt Disney said that he was convinced that not animation, but story was the heart of his studio.
When we come back, I'll be asking John why fairy tales work so well with animation. It's Happily Ever After here on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Bodacious, fabulous minds. BFM 89.9, the business station.
You're still listening to Happily Ever After here on the Evening Edition. I'm Tasha Fasil, and tonight, my guest, John Canemaker, an Academy Award-winning animator and professor, has been sharing stories about some of the earliest animated fairy tales that Disney Studios brought to the silver screen. Now, of course, fairy tales weren't the only thing that the studios were making at the time. There was Fantasia and Dumbo. But for Walt Disney, fairy tales were a good canvas to start with because, according to John, they were like a blank slate in a way.
The characters are very definite. It's kind of a black and white world, you know. There's not that much nuance. But what fairy tales gives you is a license to do what you want with them. I mean, we've seen fairy tales that have been modernized. We've seen fairy tales that make fun of the genre of telling stories that way. Disney took it seriously and was happy to have characters that had a definite story. There was a, you know, good fighting evil, you know, plot to it. There were definite archetypes and characters that you knew where they stood. So he took that and he was able to hang all sorts of embellishments of entertainment and art direction and dramatic staging. All of that was put on top of this very simple story of someone finding themselves and fighting for their lives.
But before doing a feature-length film like Snow White, he had experimented in the same ways with a series of short stories called Silly Symphonies. And there's one story in particular called Three Little Pigs that you might remember watching when you were younger.
That simple story of the big bad wolf coming to eat the three little pigs, and one of them having a house of sticks, one of them having one of straw, and then finally one having a house of brick that the wolf couldn't get through. He took that and with music and personality, giving each of those pigs a definite personality.
I built my house of sticks. I built my house of sticks.
Plus the wolf.
I'll huff and I'll puff and I'll blow your house in.
He was able to change that ancient fairy tale into something modern and contemporary that really communicated with the audience. The film was made in the Depression era, and so to have three little vulnerable pigs fighting this mean force, the big bad wolf, resonated with the American audience in the 1930s because they were undergoing the wolf at their door. Their lives were being threatened by the poverty that was surrounding them because of the Depression. So he was able to take a fairy tale, modernize it enough for that period, the 1930s, and it became an enormous success. It also encouraged him to try to do the same thing when he got into feature-length animation.
And, I mean, Disney definitely is the person to credit, right, for making fairy tales, for giving fairy tales sort of the platform and elevating it to the status that it is today. And I mean, and they're still doing it now.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you could break down any of the successful stories and find a kind of simple through line in which the character finds himself. So the character overcomes an obstacle, becomes a heroic character, whether it's a male or a female character. They're everywhere. I mean, look at Pixar with Finding Dory or Monsters, Inc. Any of those have a very simple character line that characters learning a lesson, overcoming an obstacle, becoming more themselves, and finding happiness at the end. You know, that's the great lollipop at the end of any fairy tale is to have a happy ending. You know, it's what human beings want because we know our own lives end in death. And so these fantasies give us hope that maybe there is something later or maybe you can survive death. It's all sort of a little game that's played between the audience and the filmmakers.
So with recent animations that follow that strong fairy tale genre, like stories like Frozen and Moana, there's definitely a certain similarity in terms of how they look, actually. And I'm wondering if that's because they've decided that this sort of look is very marketable, or whether they've decided that this is something that children can identify with the most.
Yes, I think you've put your finger on the reasons for that. You know, there is a marketing element that now is very important. When these films are costing millions of dollars, they must make back their money. And then the advertising on top of it is another, you know, millions and millions of dollars. So they've marketed this to maximum effect, to bring in the biggest audience. And that affects the content, it affects the look of the characters, and it affects the story as well. That's why there is, in many ways, a similarity between them. But there are other ways of doing animation and using animation, and many of the different techniques are seen at film festivals, and there's a niche market, not a wide market, for many of the other kinds of films that are not CGI. But big studio CGI films do have a kind of conformist attitude in terms of trying to succeed very, very hard and emulating the last success.
And do you think that has in any way evolved? I mean, of course, fairy tales or Disney animations have definitely evolved technically. Yes. But yeah, have these changing sentiments that people have about fairy tales, have they changed the way that fairy tales are told through animation at least?
Well, I think you put your finger on it, that the techniques are the thing that have changed. The stories remain the same. I mean, they tell the same kind of morals, the things I've just mentioned, finding yourself, overcoming a terrible problem. That sort of thing remains the same. It's the message that's hidden underneath all the entertainment and everything else. But the techniques have changed. Digital animation is in the forefront now, although hand-drawn is still a viable option. And because of the technology now, there is a great mixture of techniques that are used in single films. My students at NYU are constantly making films that combine CGI, hand-drawn, special effects, after effects. All of these different techniques are molded into telling the story now, and sometimes they're very well disguised so that you're not aware that they're there. The recent films from Leica Studio, Kubo and the Two Strings, have you seen that?
Oh, that was amazing. Was it stop animation?
It's stop motion. It is stop motion, but it is also After Effects. It is also hand-drawn and then, you know, disguised in some way. So it's telling story about someone trying to find themselves and fulfill themselves, but the techniques used are now a mixture. There's so many choices now in terms of how you can tell the story. And it doesn't all have to be very much like a live-action film, but animation, you know, even stick figures. There's a wonderful film called A Boy in the World from Brazil that was released last year. A marvelous film, but it looks like stick figure paper animated drawings of very simple characters, but beautifully designed in terms of color and in terms of the emotional impact. I've done films in which the characters are very simply designed, but still, how you place them in the frame, how you give them personality, will affect the audience, no matter what the technique is. And in fact, the problem with computer animation is that so much is possible now, that the choices are so many, that discretion is the thing that really needs to be learned, so that you're not just doing effects for effect's sake. You know, it doesn't matter how many huge explosions you have in a film. It's caring about the characters. They're in the explosions. That's important.
My thanks to John Canemaker, my guest this evening. If you know anyone who's a fan of animation or Disney animation, you can share this podcast, which is available from our website, bfm.my, or our app, which you can get on iTunes and Google Play. You can also find us on Apple CarPlay, which is available in certain car makes. Thanks for listening. I'm Tasha Fasil, and this has been Happily Ever After on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Jay Farner, CEO of Quicken Loans. 30% of Americans who are planning home improvements of $5,000 or more will pay for those renovations with a high-interest credit card. That may not be a great idea. A better idea may be to take cash out of your home with a Quicken Loans 30-year fixed-rate mortgage. The rate today on our 30-year fixed-rate mortgage is 4.375%, APR 4.65%. Call us today at 800-QUICKEN or go to rocketmortgage.com.
Rate subject to change. Pay 2.13% fee to receive this discounted rate. Call for cost information and conditions. Equal housing lender. License in all 50 states. NMLS number 3030.